Humanitarian Toolbox with Richard Campbell.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host, helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using all and everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. And I'm doing a ton of online user group presentations and speaking. If you run a .NET or Azure-related user group, I'd love to give a presentation for you. Just reach out. And today, our top sponsor, ClearMeasure, makes this podcast happen. They are a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be more self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results and have to outsource less. And if we can help, please get in touch. Also, be sure to check out the new video show, Architect Tips. And today's interview is part one of a two-part conversation with Richard Campbell. And we're going to do the humanitarian toolbox topic first. And be sure to watch out for the next show where we go into the history of .NET and beyond. And so let's roll part one. And we have back on the show today, Richard Campbell, and he was on the show back in episode 45, and here we are, episode 132, so we're trucking along.
Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
You know?
So Richard is an entrepreneur, advisor, a rabid podcaster, as he describes himself in his LinkedIn profile, and he's also a Microsoft Regional Director, the co-host of .NET Rocks, Run As Radio, and has so much more experience and accomplishments that I couldn't possibly list them all. You can find him on Twitter at Rich Campbell. And Rich, we've been friends for over a decade. I'm not sure it's quite two yet, but
it's getting close because I remember you writing to .NET Rocks as a driver in Iraq.
Was it back then? That was 03.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the first shows were 2002, right? Mm-hmm. Which is before the word podcast even exists.
Right, right.
But, you know, you were kind of a legendary story in .NET Rocks lore back then.
Someone from overseas. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and an American overseas is like, this is what you were doing in your truck. Like, it was amazing.
That was fun. We just happened to be, well, it was a download as many MP3 files as possible and then listen to them kind of, you know, at night in between things. And I happened to be, we were taking a load of essentially broken down tanks. You take the broken down stuff from Iraq down to Kuwait where they have all the maintenance facilities and whatnot. And they had, you know, the AT&T phone banks. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. They're actually doing live call-ins. I might be able to do this. Let me see. And the schedule just happened to line up before we had to get back across the border. And that was fun calling in.
Too funny. It's amazing. What's the other, my favorite Jeff Palermo story? Oh, when I talked the chef at one of those restaurants to making you a 48-ounce steak, and you ate it. But first you called your wife. I remember when I talked him into it, they bring this thing. First the chef came out and looked at you. He's like, okay, that boy could actually eat that thing. Goes away, comes back, brings this enormous piece of prime rib, and you cleared the plate of everything else. You called your wife and said, I'm doing something stupid. And then you sat down and ate that thing.
I do remember them asking, okay, it comes with two sides, what would you like? And I kind of looked at them like, nope, no sides.
Doesn't matter. Not important.
But was that the MVP summit, I think? Anyway, I remember 2 days afterwards, I didn't eat anything. I think the second day I maybe ate some carrots to try to get some fiber to
something just to get things going.
I was feeling a little bit awkward the next 2 days.
I think it might have been in Canada. I might have been at a conference in Canada. Like it went one of Darcy Lussier shows, something like that. That's what I'm thinking. It was one of those.
Oh, yeah.
But they all blur together, don't they? It's very funny.
And I'll never do that again, by the way. No. That was not smart.
There's just bad behavior on everybody's part. I feel bad about it. You feel bad about it. Like that was too much food. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it was. Although I've gone to I've gone to purchasing my own cows and for processing and just putting it in the deep freeze instead of just like, you know, one at a time hamburger meat or steaks or ribs from the grocery store. I'm like, no. Let me get it in season. I'll put it in the deep freeze.
And do you buy a calf or a quarter? Like, how much meat is that?
Well, it's up to you. I went to Texas A&M University, which is a big ag school in Texas. And so literally a friend I went to college with is a rancher. And so it's like, it's a text message transaction. And so so this past year I bought half a cow. I should have bought the whole cow because then I had to buy a quarter cow in the fall just to tide me over.
Fill in. Yeah. Just buy it all. That's very funny.
It's fresh. And I mean, I get to hear his commentary. He's like, no. These cows just walk around and eat. That's their diet.
Yeah.
No chemicals, no pesticides.
Very natural. Yeah. You really know the origin of your food.
Right.
It's a friend of yours making that food for you. That's really great.
Yeah. Yeah. I bought my first lamb. It should get here in a couple weeks from county fair, just about 3 hours drive here in Texas. You know, the kids raise a lamb, enter it in the fair, and then sell it at auction. So that should be fun. Anyway, I digress. I'd like to ask you about some of the new things and something you've been doing for a long time, Humanitarian Toolbox. It's been going for a while, but how's it going?
It's like 2012. It came out of the road trip, the .NET Rocks road trip in 2012. And it really, part of it was me just sort of frustrated with how hard it was for software developers to donate their time to charity in a way that was completely mutually beneficial. Because we know, you know, we've built a lot of software. Like, software takes care and feeding. You can't just work on it once in a while. It needs to be maintained. And so HDBox was really about, hey, we'll take over the maintenance responsibilities and allow volunteer developers to contribute their coding times and not have to worry about the rest of the stuff. And we ended up being pulled into disaster response and preparedness for a few reasons. I mean, one is it was an area that clearly could use some smartphone and cloud technologies. And it also sees no borders, you know, earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes, like, they happen everywhere in the world. Everyone can benefit from this. And that's one of the reasons we focused on open source for this as well. It's like, I don't like the idea of that software being owned or controlled, where you have to pick one person gets to use it, nobody else does. Like, that doesn't jive for me. If this software can help you, you can use it. That we could build up a set of routines, a set of apps that could help people, be a toolbox during a disaster. And it's a very challenging space to work in, but it's been a lot of fun. We've built a few different things along the way. The current project, which has been gestating for the better part of a year now, is called 2 Weeks Ready. And it comes from disaster preparedness professionals. So the folks, you know, in the US, it's FEMA and sort of state level disaster preparedness. And Canada has similar structures and it's not that different elsewhere in the world. Are acknowledging that in major disasters, you and your family may be essentially on your own for up to 2 weeks. And so given that circumstance, how could you take care of your family for that long? At its simplest level, it's just this planning. It's like, well, here's what the professionals say you need to have, you know, for each person, for each child, for each pet, things like medicine and so forth. And now you think of the obvious thing, which is not only just maintaining that list and, you know, each time you're going to go shopping, what should I add to it next? Because you're not going to buy it all at once, but also keeping track of expiry dates.
Yeah.
You know, I live in the Pacific Northwest. We have earthquake tsunami risks here and volcanoes and fun things like that. And went through my box the other day and here's some cup of soups from 2008. You know, I know you don't want that to be the food.
Who's ready for an adventure?
Yeah. But better still would be that the phone pops up at you and says, hey, this is going to expire in the next 6 months. Why don't you eat it? You know, don't waste it. And then, you know, buy some new. So that's a pretty straightforward, you know, you think about it from a development perspective, none of this is voodoo.
Right.
The trickier one are the preparedness plans. you know, a typical fan, you know, your atomic family, there's only going to be one member who's the preparedness person, right? That's going to worry about this stuff.
Right, right.
But everybody needs to know it. And maybe you've had that conversation about, hey, here's where we gather after after a crisis, if the house isn't available, or here's the neighbor's phone number, like all of those bits and pieces of information that everybody in the family should know, but probably only one person does. So what if we were able to have everyone with a smartphone have all that data on hand? So that you build up that list and then synchronize across the phones. Now, that's a lot of personal information. So a big part for me would be, how do we let you synchronize that list, but only you have it? So, you know, part of the architecture of the app was encrypted on the phone, and you designate who has the keys to decrypt it. So everybody in your family can decrypt it, but nobody else can. So we can operate a back-end infrastructure to give you a backup of that, but we can't unpack it. There's no way to have it. And that way because we don't need that info. Like, that info is just liability for us. We won't be the source of a breach around info,
right,
like that.
Right.
But you can share what you want with your family, nowhere else.
Hmm. You know, I think Texas got a little taste of maybe what that would be for a few days.
Yeah, you guys had a bad month. Like, that was tough.
Well, it is interesting. It was about a 4-day period, and we could see the weather forecast. Oh, it's going to be 65 degrees Fahrenheit on Friday, but it was 9 degrees
but first,
Fahrenheit.
Negative 10.
Yes. Well, yeah. Negative 10 Celsius. But
yeah.
And it's funny. It's the electricity, and they're still trying to unwind what happened, but
yeah.
I heard that the windmills that the contractor's like, oh, what windmill should we install here in West Texas and capture all that wind? Well, apparently not the ones that they install in the Northeast that don't freeze when it's cold. These, they're just like, okay, they're frozen. And then, yeah,
well, and there's water and natural gas, and that's going to freeze if the ground gets cold enough. You know, did you bury them deep? Because they pump gas up north, but you spend extra to bury them deep. And I don't know that you'd do that in Texas,
right? And then the fossil fuel plants in Texas, we had plenty of those, but they require federal permission to turn them on and get a waiver for emissions. And it took a couple days for the bureaucratic process to say yes. So in the meantime, Texans are like, okay, a third of you or half of you are going to have power and the rest of you aren't. Well, what is that? When a business doesn't know if it's going to have electricity,
you talk
about a lockdown for COVID. No, this was every business shuts down because they don't know if their building's going to have electricity that day.
Yeah.
And then no gas, no propane, no delivery, no, all the trucking to deliver stuff, nothing. Not to mention the roads like are not getting plowed because old Mel doesn't know, you know, there's one plow for the whole region. Who knows?
Yeah. Why would you have a plow? You don't get snow down there. That's crazy.
Well, we also don't have ice pods of storage for salt all along the roadways.
Yeah.
So
why would you do that? No, it was definitely a tough time in Texas. No two ways about it. And so great to think in terms of emergency preparedness, what that looks like. You also, I mean, you guys are tornado country too, right?
North Power, Texas.
Pretty seriously.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Are there any success stories that this is already kind of generated?
We're still in the midst of development right now. It's early days. We're making some good progress. And again, open source project. Front end is Vue as a progressive web app. Back end has been mostly Azure Functions, and still in development. But yeah, we're working closely with a few different disaster response teams, and I'm looking further afield because I don't know if you've been following the news just in the past week or two relative to when we recorded, maybe a month or so from now, from when this is published. There was a major earthquake in the South Pacific, and New Zealand and Australia both went under tsunami alerts.
Mm.
And so, I mean, tsunamis are incredibly destructive when they're large. Just ask, you know, we think about in 2004, the one that rolled across the Indian Ocean. It's just unbelievable the amount of damage they do. And they're relatively slow moving. Like you have some time to get to higher ground, mm-hmm. but they are unstoppable forces. And when they do their damage, it's amazing and dramatic. And you will have to sustain yourself an extended period of time. Yeah. So it's important for you to know the route to get to high enough ground, to get above where a tsunami could possibly reach, and to get there quickly too. And so the fact that we could have an app that would do those notifications, and the one that just happened in New Zealand, a friend of mine who's down there, and I have family down there as well, sent me the screenshot of the alert. So their phone went off. They have a nationalized system down there. So they are able to broadcast to all phones. Okay, there's a tsunami alert. Move to higher ground if you're in these areas. And the alert looked fantastic. But it's not going to, that's enough to let you know, okay, you've got trouble. Now, do you know what to do? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the conversation we were having is what 2 weeks ready would do in that circumstance, which is now it shows you your personal plan for, okay, if you're at work, here's the quickest way to higher ground. If you're at school, here's the quickest way to higher ground. All those sorts of paths that you can preload and share with your family so that you're ready to do what you need to get to safety.
And is it just me, or does it seem like the cell phone networks are pretty resilient even when other yes. bad stuff is going on?
Well, there's a few things about cell that's really interesting. First is it never works perfectly even in the best of times, but it never fully fails either. They're also essential parts of emergency response these days, because generally speaking, if you're a first responder in an emergency site, where you find a phone, you find a person. And so part of the initial deployment into a disaster area, so you think about a typhoon or a hurricane, like something that does, or earthquakes, tremendous amounts of damage. One of the first things on the ground are portable cell towers. They're truck-based generators, and they'll drive them into an area, put the mast up, and connect with all the phones, because that's now information for first responders to go find those phones.
Oh, yeah.
And so the time limit is very short. Like they got a day to get them in there and to try and find people off the backs of their phones. And the side effect of that is, even in major disasters, there is some cell coverage. Now, it's no 4G, 5G, like high speed, but
it works.
It's enough. And it's part of what we've been talking about with many of the apps we've worked with using smartphones, where it's like, we communicate on text message for a reason. A, we don't want to move a lot of data. B, that's a piece of the network that works the longest. When many other things are broken, that still works, because SMS is actually based on the handshake protocol for cell phones to connect a network, period. So if a phone's working in any way, it can do text message.
Mm, interesting. Interesting. The old ham radio network, there's still clubs, and I'm a part of my local one.
Oh, sure.
But even in the storm, one of the main repeaters went down. So I'm like, yeah. Okay. Well, then your radio can't get to the next repeater. It's like that network hasn't been maintained as much, and all the cell phones coming out. So you're thinking, okay, what's the most foolproof way? And it just may be the one where everybody's on.
Yeah. What have we got the most of? What is already modular, mm-hmm. and designed to be replaced in a modular way? What can run on relative ranges of power? Like, it is astonishing. I did some work around the Cayman Islands after a major hurricane there, after Ivan blew through. And I mean, it took almost every power pole off that entire island, but the cell tower that is a part of the telco building where the undersea cable comes in, it survived, and it had a generator.
Nice.
And so if you were close enough to that module, and let's face it, the cables are just not that big, like that worked. It wasn't fast, but it worked.
So if any developers want to get involved, where should their starting point be?
Few opportunities. So you can go to humanitariantoolbox.org. However, you have to be able to spell humanitarian. The easy way is htbox.org.
Okay.
So that's the shorthand. So that's our website. It'll talk about the different projects. We are a 501c3 charity. So you often get matching funds. Some companies will even match volunteer hours with funds as well. So being a registered charity was helpful. The projects itself live on GitHub. So if you go to github.com/htbox, you will see an array of projects there. 2 weeks ready right now, one of the most active ones, but not the only one, in a variety of different technologies and a variety of states of evolution, and always happy to have contributions. What I would say is we're not typical open source projects in the sense that we're fishing for ideas of what to build. We're working with disaster response and preparedness professionals. The work items that are listed on our projects were developed by them, in conjunction with them. We're looking for volunteers who read those items, find inspiration, and like, that would be something I'd want to work on. Mm-hmm. Chat with us, you know, exchange some messages. We're happy to get more people involved, and you can add code to the project.
I remember, it might have been 6 or 7 years ago. And I think there was this a weekend coding project. There was a few. I just attended it. There was a few HTBox customers that were lined up, and they just made their request. And there was a pool of developers who raised their hand. I think Carl was in Austin, Texas for that one. Carl Franklin.
Yeah, I mean, that might have been a give camp, but we certainly did codeathons around HTBox projects.
Yeah, it was one of those codeathons, and I remember one of the requests was they had a string of Excel spreadsheets, tons of data, and they said, "Oh, we need to get it into here." And of course, the programmers, you know, professional programmers, looked at that and like, that's all you need. And to this company, it was a mountain of work. Labor is over the top. And they look at that and like, it looks like some Excel macros, or looks like, you know, something to read in. No big deal. It's a tiny amount of effort, but it was such
hours of work changed everything.
Right. Such a huge impact. And so I guess my point is that not all needs translate into a mountain of work.
You're totally true. And often, you know, this conversation around things like, there are many tools that already exist to make this stuff easier and quicker and to help bring these non-technology organizations into taking advantage of technology. Because of the pandemic, of course, codeathons are kind of a bad idea right now. What we have been doing is doing events on Twitch. Mm-hmm. So various coding streamers have been working on HTBox projects, and other folks have been contributing while they've been watching. So they've been doing, you know, half day long streams, and folks get involved and you can actually see your pull request get pulled in and added to the project. And because it's a PWA, literally as soon as the CI/CD pipeline kicks in, anybody can open up the app in its development state and see the new feature.
Right.
So that's been really fun to see the sort of new way to work.
Well, that was part one of a two-part series with Richard Campbell. Go to github.com/htbox or just search the web for Humanitarian Toolbox or HTBox to find out more how to get involved there. And as always, dear listener, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.